when I smelled it, it smelled like my grandmother. And it almost was like, you know, like this is it. This is this like familiarity of like, so this is what Tripoli smells like, but also this is what my family smells like.
لما قلت أجندة خوفتني في الأول.
Oh, there's always like no على خاطر الناس بس okay من هم الناس.
والإنسان اللي مش مطلع يسهل جدا إنه هو يصير لغسيل المخ هذا.
Time مش بس money, time is everything.
2011 developed depression.
في نفس الوقت هو يدق قاعد يقول بقى حتى لو عجبتش يمشي بلع.
أي choice تأخذه فيه consequence ممكن يضيع لك حياتك وممكن يركبك فوق.
واللي كان يعذب فيه كنت نعرف علاش إنه هو يدير فيه.
أنا عم بحاول بس أنه بس رسالة أنه ننتصر على الشيء الصعب اللي صار معنا بس هيك.
أنا متحمس. أنتوا واتين. يلا نبدو. Welcome to episode 36 of the Miri podcast. I'm your host طارق الميري. This episode is in English. هذه الحلقة بالإنجليزي وحيكون لها ترجمة في موقع البودكاست themiri.ly بعد نهاية الموسم. Could you ever belong to a place you've never visited? A place you've never seen? A place you've never smelt, felt, or had any memories in? Could you actually feel connected to the birthplace of your parents, where they started their lives more than the land you're born in? The one you hold a passport to? Even if that place you long for is not welcoming to you, and your parents have had the worst experience in it before they had to run out of it? If you have listened to enough the Miri episodes, you already know how much I'm obsessed with the question of identity and belonging. This episode is mostly about that. Sometime earlier this year, Karen got in touch with me through Instagram after listening to her first the Miri episode. She told me that after listening to the episode, she felt a stronger connection to Libya and the Libyans she heard. Since talking to her, I have been extremely fascinated by her story, her enthusiasm to connect with her roots, and exceptional hospitality. All of that I felt from a distance. Karen's story covers an aspect of Libyan history that I've never been introduced to. It opened my eyes into a slice of Libyan society that has been disappeared from it many years ago. Every time we spoke, I got more curious to know more about her, her family, and what happened to them. What was her aunt's connection to King Idris of Libya? Why does she feel Libyan? How is growing up in Israel like? Why does she feel more Arab than Israeli? Needless to say, this had to be a long conversation. I invited her for Libyan-style tadriza, and lucky me, she said yes. Jewish Libyan and the daughter of Libyans is how she introduced herself. My guest today is Karen Elgai, a fashion stylist, a mom, and soon to be a karaoke bar owner living in New York. I'm excited. Are you ready? Let's do it.
I love the music you sent, by the way. It's really crazy. Diverse and rich,
yeah.
And completely disconnected. Like, it feels like you have a massive palette, like way more than I ever had, which is impressive.
I grew up playing music, so music for musicians kind of thing. I have a very wide selection of things I enjoy.
Before we get there and hit play and start listening to this music, I just want to say I'm very excited to have you. I'm very excited to have this conversation.
Thank you.
I'm so curious to know a lot more about you and dig deeper into our previous conversation. So I hope you find joy in this.
So honored to be here.
You ready?
Yeah.
All right. Let's start with the easy part. Let's do the music. I think we'll take it from there. So it has a video component. This is unusual. It's usually I want people to close their eyes and imagine something, but there's something about the video that is, yeah, I don't want to give too much, but let's just go.
Libya, before I leave you to my land, before I leave your warmth and sun, give me your love, give me your hand, say goodbye. Give me your love, give me your hand, give me your love, give me your hand, say goodbye. I will be back again. صوف مصراتك وانسى يجوبك هو.
I love it.
Have you came across this one before?
No.
A friend of mine and I are researching a bit of, you know, music and different genres from the scene. And she's a music head, like big, sort of researching these really random things that you cannot easily access. And I'm like, how come I've never heard of this one before? It's to me, it's so bad that it's good at the same time. So... But I don't know, how does it make you feel? Like, where do you go when you're like, you know, experiencing this epic piece?
Usually when I come across Libyan music, it's not in English.
Mm-mm.
So okay. It's definitely different.
That's probably a good thing.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm not mad about okay. It. It made me a little emotional because I do want to go very badly.
Curious to find out a bit more why that is, why that connection and why you're interested slightly after, you know, you introduce yourself a bit more. But just a little context around this epic piece, because it's on YouTube and it's translated really badly, because he says, give me your hand, and it's written as give me your heart. So it's further more confusing than it needs to be. And so in 1967, I think Ministry of Tourism imagined this tourist coming to visit Libya, and this is what they'll be saying after they leave. So this is basically the voice of a tourist after they've experienced everything Libya had to offer. So yeah, that's that. It's quite interesting. I mean, I had so many other options to share with you, including an Algerian singer that sings in French, but he made that language his own. Like, it almost created a different dimension of the culture. So leading with that, you actually do want to visit Libya and you're really interested in connecting more. I'd love to, before we jump into that a bit more, like, if you introduce yourself to someone, you know, a friendly face that you happen to be in a casual setting in an airport or in a cafe, like, how would Karen introduce herself? Where would you start? Where would you end if you had like 3 to 5 minutes?
So I'm Karen Elgai. I am the daughter of Libyans. I'm a fashion stylist. I am soon to be a karaoke bar owner. I am a mom. I've been living in New York for this month will be 13 years. I am Jewish Libyan, which kind of sets me a little bit apart from my other Libyan friends, which due to quarantine, that group of friends is getting larger and larger. And I'm extremely grateful for those friends. I also find this very fitting because today is the eve of the Jewish New Year. So, Shana Tova.
Happy New Year, or is it?
Happy New Year.
Is Rosh Hashanah or Rosh Hashanah? I think it's similar.
Rosh Hashanah.
It's so similar. Like, it's in a way... I guess the closest country to Libyan is Maltese, and there is so many letters, so many words that connect. But obviously in Hebrew to Arabic also, there's a clear connection if your ears are familiar. But obviously it is the familiarity issue that makes things a bit distant and confusing.
Rosh Hashanah translates to head of the year. So it's Ras and Rosh. Quite similar, yeah.
You've thrown in so many labels, and that's how you see yourself. But obviously it is... complex yet super interesting. So Jewish, yet you feel Arab, yet you connect to Libya and you see yourself as Libyan, and you're a New Yorker as well. So it's that simple complexity that you run with every day, like, which appears to you in different settings. Like, are you all of those things all the time? Are you some of those things?
Probably not all of those things all the time. So I was thinking about last night about how I kind of code switch when I'm around my Arab friends and around my American friends. And you probably wouldn't find me saying like, mashallah, or something like that around my American friends, because it would be extremely out of context. But when I'm with my Arab friends, like, everything is mashallah, mashallah, you know? So yeah, definitely not all those things all the time on the outside, but for sure on the inside, yeah. And that's who I am.
Definitely. I mean, the way I connected with you is really interesting. So I had a connection to the anti-Libyan, Instagram page, which some people love and some people hate, and it's weird. I don't know. It's like an Instagram account that could be controversial. Maybe it's just a name. But right after when that page posted about one of the episodes, we got connected. I don't remember like if it's me or you or the other way around. Your story got to me really in an immediate way, in a relevant way, because of the identity element. You know, like, I'm someone who always feels out of place. Always feels that I don't belong, anywhere, even though I had access to Libya, where my parents are from, even though I lived in the US where I was born. I don't know, maybe it's the way I'm designed. I'm always looking for the things that make me feel that I don't belong. You, on the other hand, is someone who is complete opposite, which is really refreshing. You find the elements that you connect with. And for you, that's almost enough, or for you, that's enough basis to feel that you have a connection. Is that true, or is that very shallow observation from my end?
I don't think it's shallow, but I think it comes from a different place. So I don't know if it's like a generalization of Arab people, but in my family, we are big on hosting. And growing up, there were always people in the house. And in my home, pre-pandemic, there were always people around, or people staying with us, or people eating with us. I think in every space, I kind of almost give myself the title of like host, of like, come on in. So welcome to my podcast.
Usually at this point, I'll give you, you know, the handheld mic, but I've upgraded. Yeah. So I'm sorry, I can't move this ridiculously heavy thing, but it's yours for the moment. It's yours.
But yeah, I think, I don't know, maybe it's my years in being in recovery spaces, just learning that we kind of all belong, you know. We're so much alike that to feel a lack of a belonging almost feels irresponsible to the people you're really with. So yeah, I mean, often I feel like I don't belong, but, and there's also a big part of like imposter syndrome of like, I've never stepped foot in Libya and yet I call myself Libyan.
When did that start? Like when was the moment you're like, you know what, I'm not any of these nationalities. I feel like I have the right to choose, even though I don't have the paperwork. But when did it scream at you that you have connection to this land, the history, family, roots, that you need to like, just, you know, unfold and reconnect with, for lack of a better term?
There was always kind of a note in the background of the family history, but nobody in my family would talk about it. And my friend Masoud Hayoun came out with a book, When We Were Arabs, and it's about his family's history in Tunisia and Egypt. Also Jewish family. And as I started reading the book, Masoud and I became closer and closer as friends, and he was helping me into my family's history. And I think people of my generation, like the kids of the late 80s, there's like an awakening and a craving to learn like where we come from, what's our history. And you'd see it. Okay, so I was born and raised in Israel. And, you know, I even have certain discomfort in calling the physical land Israel, in a way. And I definitely don't feel Israeli, probably because I equate being Israeli with Zionism, which I'm not. So I think somewhere I was looking for the place that is mine, the place that is my home. And the more I learned about Libya, the more things like clicked and more things like made sense in my, I guess, aspects of my personality, things I enjoy, the food I cook. So with reading the book and with investigating and asking my parents questions when they were here, when I was still pregnant with my son, who's now a year and 2 months, just trying to learn more about my family. And it really is such a beautiful story. And when I asked my mom, why does nobody talk about it? She said, because nobody's asking about it. So I'm really glad I asked.
I know, it's one of those things, right? Like, it's not that it is secretive, but people feel that you have to care enough to ask and create that moment for them to present that information to you, because habits, or because of how painful that experience or that end of that chapter for them, it almost is self-protection for you and for them. That's a complete assumption.
I think there was definitely pain there, for sure. There was definitely pain in the experience of like having a relationship with your neighbors that was very familiar, and very like familiar from the word family. They were very close. And then when the Six-Day War broke in Israel, like all hell broke loose and there was violence toward Jews, it was really inescapable, it seemed, in Libya. So yeah, I think that kind of, I mean, I'm assuming it felt like a betrayal for both sides, for the Muslim Libyans and the Jewish Libyans.
I mean, it is kind of symptomatic and connected to what's happening in country now, of like different neighbors, different cities, different allegiances. When politics plays a heavy role, even if it's external politics, it digs deep and it really destroys beautiful bonds and connections and history and culture that way. I'm really curious to dig deeper with, you know, from your mom's side, from your dad's side, your bigger connection to the country. But in a way, there's something that I'm exploring now, and it's very similar, that I've missed as a chapter of my history or my identity, and it's also shared with you, is this whole history of colonialism in Libya, Italian colonialism specifically, is also something that is not talked about. And if it's you didn't really dig deep, you won't get access to the story, to the story, the camps, the horrific events that took place, unless you were present with the right people at the right age to ask them those questions. And you did mention that there's a side of your dad's family in particular that ended up in camps, right? In 47?
Yeah. Well, both sides of my family, my grandparents were in the Jiadu camps.
In the mountains, yeah.
Yeah, my mom's side and my dad's side.
What's the story there? Like, how did you find out, and what details of the story, and how, why did the camps come about? If whatever it is that you know about, it'll be really enlightening.
So yeah, I think the camps came about... Oof, I really don't know the details, and since it's like historical accuracy, I'm afraid I'll say like the wrong names. But yeah, in 47 was when my family was put in the camps, and I guess it was an arm of World War II that arrived in Libya. So I didn't know that it got there. I didn't know that Libya was affected at all by Europe and everything going on in Europe at the time. So growing up, we always had like the Holocaust Memorial Day, and it always felt like an Ashkenazi Jew like memorial, you know, it's not ours in a way.
What's that in particular? When you say Ashkenazi, is that a specific denomination? Is that from a country specific culture background?
So Ashkenazi Jews are the Jews of Europe, of European descent. And then Mizrahi, Sephardic or Arab Jews are from Arab countries, but Mizrahi translates to Western and Sephardic translates to Spanish. So it's kind of words that were given to Arab Jews to make the word Arab derogatory, to, God forbid, keep them from like identifying with Palestinians and having solidarity with the Palestinians. So they gave it a different name. They made Arab like a bad word.
Well, I think it's vital when you're manufacturing, patriotism and connection to a new idea. It's always in the minds of politicians to make us feel or think one way or another by design.
That was definitely by design. That was definitely like self-hatred propaganda, because I've heard my parents use the word Arab as derogatory while a second later speaking Arabic at home, you know? And our culture is Arab, and our culture is so beautiful, and it makes me really upset to see them feel anything but pride.
It must have been hard work for you internally to connect, identify, and feel pride and change the mindset and have these conversations. But all of it was way after you left Israel. This is sort of your New York years, or like you always had the question of like, I really don't belong here. I don't connect. I don't want to be part of the army. I identify with Palestinians. Or, you know, at which period did it, you know, go up and down or start?
It always went up and down. So growing up, like early teen years, I would be obsessed with the idea of serving in the army. And I would be dressed in like olive greens all the time. That was my favorite color as a child. And like the idea of serving in the army was like, oh my God, I'm so excited. I can't wait. And then you grow up and you understand a little bit more about the role of the army and who gets hurt in the process and why a certain situation is how it is. And as I understood, it became less and less attractive, which I think it was very strange for my family, because I was really, really obsessed with the idea of serving in the army. And then within just a few short years, it was like, they can't get me in there. I will not do it.
That in itself is not possible, right? Because it is mandatory.
It is mandatory, yeah. So males serve 3 years and female soldiers serve a year and 9 months. And they can volunteer for more time or get hired for more time. But it's mandatory. So during the interviews there, it was really extremely, extremely difficult. I was physically violent. I was just... It seemed allergic to people during the entire process. And at like the final meeting, they were like, well, you chose the most wrong answers of each like questions we gave you. You just like been extremely difficult. And they were like, why are you so difficult? And I told them, I have no interest in serving in the army. And they gave me the lack of placement options due to the needs of the military. It's not you, it's me kind of excuse. And that was a big relief. It was a big relief to not have to serve.
I know you mentioned that you felt lonely the whole time you're there in the country, but How does it feel to be in that country, like generally? Like, because it is the one exception in the whole region. It's different culturally, different language, different lifestyle. It is possibly the most advanced economy. It's geographically placed, but in that space, but at the same time, it feels like it's connected to a different world. Or is none of that visible because you're actually inside the country and like you're in any other country, it doesn't really matter. Like, how does it feel like living inside as essentially a teenager? Because you didn't really live there after your 20s, right?
Yeah, I left when I was 19. And as soon as I could leave my parents' home in this very pastoral, quaint little town, I moved to Tel Aviv, which a lot of people in Israel would refer to as the bubble because it's very disconnected. It's kind of like New York with the US. Like, it has its own culture. It has its own life. But I don't think while I was there that I realized that that's what was going on. Because to us as residents and as Israelis, I guess, the image that we were sold is we are a small country surrounded by enemies. And when you frame it that way, you think, how can a country like that possibly be harmful? Or possibly be the bully when we're so surrounded from every side. That should have been the first, like, wait. Because growing up, we were kind of sold this image of like, there was just a desert here before. And we came and we settled and it's a land for the Jews and blah, 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 blah. And then we were attacked. And that's not really what happened. So yeah, it took a lot of unlearning from what they taught us in schools, I think.
Definitely. I mean, it is very interesting what the power of narrative instills in many generations. I always wonder which one of the 50 stories will be thought and embedded in, you know, Libyan children these days, you know, in regards to 2011 revolution and Gaddafi and before and the after. It just, there's like, in a way, history is still being written, but at the same time, like, which of these confusing stories will stick after 50 years from now? It's always interesting. Like, I just was in the middle of a conversation of, it's very difficult to trust history when you were part of writing the history that is being made now, knowing how much you can put in, knowing how much you can leave out, knowing how much you can reimagine and redesign in terms of sort of the media landscape, that's a very specific lens. So it's always interesting and fun to explore. Should we go a bit more personal?
This is your show.
are you giving me back my mic?
Yeah,
is that what you're doing? Like, aside from the culture, the food, and what you do day to day for work and being a mother, New Yorker, and everything in between, what are you obsessed with? What do you spend time thinking about in the afternoons, on weekends? What do you, you know, what's your muse, your escape, and the world that you spend your time having fun with and long periods of time? Obsession. What's your number one obsession?
It's funny because I wouldn't call my number one obsession the thing I escape from. My escapism is separate from what I'm obsessed with. What I'm obsessed with is probably efficiency. So I kind of always try to find solutions for using my time the way I think is best to use my time, whether it's actually using it or taking advantage of it to rest or do my escapism, which is probably research new music. I love like getting lost in building a new playlist or something.
You need to share yours because based on the sample you sent me, I feel like I'm way behind. So I'm going to steal some of your research findings.
You got it.
In terms of efficiency, are you listening to audiobooks at double speed?
I don't listen to audiobooks because as you can see from our relationship, which is like me constantly interrupting you when you speak, I am not the best listener.
It's not, by the way, it's not listening in the sense that you have to, like, you know, respect this person speaking to you. They're paid recorded service to read the book on your behalf whenever you please, madam. And you can go one and a half speed, double speed, 1.25. I don't know. If you want to reclaim some time, I recommend it. It works. It's really good.
I don't know. I've never tried listening to an audiobook. And probably like until about a year ago, it's so funny. Until Masoud's book came out, I did not refer to myself as a reader. I actually actively referred to myself as not a reader. And after reading When We Were Arabs and after reading Invisible Women by Caroline Criado Perez, those two books were like, it kind of retaught me why I stopped reading as a kid. And it's because when I finish a book, I go into extremely like deep mourning. Just the grief of being done with the story and having to kind of say goodbye, which kind of brings us back to the song that you played in the beginning. I noticed that the word goodbye is the one that made me like emotional in a way, you know? So yeah. And since those two books kind of opened me up to see what I do enjoy reading and the kind of story that keeps me interested. But to your question, I don't know if I would read it in double time. I would probably read it as the author intended, if they're the ones reading the book.
I'm obsessed with efficiency, like more, but not in a way where everything has to be sort of perfected, but like, what are your efficiency tips for someone who's like, I don't have the time, there's so much to do, I'm a mother and work, and like, and these people who are like ridiculously always stressed, or, you know, people who probably have half the responsibility, but they don't know how to crack this time code situation.
Let me see. I hope I have an example here to like do a show and tell. But I have these like charts that like a page would have like written all the things I would like to get done in a day. And each day of the month would have its column. And when I got something done, I would mark a little X. And I think it was inspired by the Seinfeld strategy that he was telling this, Jerry Seinfeld was telling this young comedian that he should get like a year calendar and then write every day, whether it's good material or bad material, just write every day. And every day that you write, mark an X. And he said, at some point, your goal stops being writing. Your goal becomes not breaking the chain. And that kind of becomes a habit and forces you to kind of come up with better material. And so I make these charts and I would mark X's that would keep me doing what I need to do. And also I would include stuff like play music or nap or just things that I need to not feel guilty about doing. And I think the really important part about those is understanding that a perfect day doesn't exist. So just remove the stress of like getting everything done. You're not going to get everything done. It's impossible. So do what you can. Let the rest wait.
Well, I mean, in that process, it's out of your head. It's on that chart. And you can track it. You're no longer like thinking, should I, should I not? And it's not haunting you, you know, and the backside of your head constantly and not being done. So it's a massive achievement. New York. I feel like I'm just obsessed with geography in this episode. Apologies. Okay. I think it's the easy way to navigate it. How did that come about? Like sort of, you know, from trying to discover your roots and your family stories and asking those questions to being somewhere completely not related to that, or is it related?
I mean, New York has the entire world in it, you know? I feel like in New York, you can really travel anywhere. And maybe it's just because I am obsessed with food, but I think food is a really great way to get to know a culture. So if we want to go to Vietnam, or if we want to go to Hawaii, or, you know, there's access to it in New York. I think Queens, the borough of Queens, has the most languages in the world in one place, which is phenomenal. I love the city so much. And with everything going on politically, my husband and I were kind of entertaining the possibility that if the elections don't really go how we would like them to go in November, the possibility of leaving the US and leaving New York. And I'm having a hard time even having that conversation because New York is such a home for me, you know? So we were talking to our friends that you also know, Wissal and Ahmed. We kind of fantasize with them about where we're all going to live together one day in Morocco. We were like sending each other real estate listings in Morocco and talking about how much we love North Africa.
So that's a close enough location. It's very cool. Is there a Libyan restaurant in New York?
I couldn't find one yet. I heard there are a few on Steinway, which is in Queens, but I haven't had a chance to be there yet. And yeah, I don't know. I haven't had a chance to, because, you know, I cook most of the Libyan food that I consume. So that's the closest to like my family's cooking that I can come to. So
it's all inspired by your family's own recipes. It's not stuff that you're looking up and starting new. It's stuff you've been eating forever at home.
So my aunt Norma is the daughter of my great aunt Tony, who was the personal cook for King Idris. Those are all the royal recipes. That's what we cook at home.
Oh, wow. So you learned directly from her, or you learned from your mom who learned from her?
If I would want a recipe, my mom would text Norma, and Norma would give my mom the recipe, and my mom in her handwriting would send me a photo of her handwritten recipe. I really should write them down, because if I delete my WhatsApp images album to like save some space, they're all gone. So I really need to like put them pen to paper.
And is stuff your aunt, you said Norma, right?
Yeah, Norma is Tony's daughter, yeah.
Oh, okay, I'm confused. So Tony is the personal chef, right?
Taking care of us, yeah. Yeah.
Norma is her daughter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's stuff that they still cook now, right? Like, what is that? Like, what kind of meals do you cook from that?
So I cook becha all the time. And I think the first solid food my son had was mafoum, which I know some people call it mbatan, right?
Mbatan. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the potato stuffed with ground meat. Yeah.
With the meat. Yeah. So the way we make it, we do the potato stuffed with the meat and spices and onions and everything, and then deep fry that, and then cook the fried mafoum in the stew. I think mbatan is without the stew, right?
I'm an authority on eating that, not so much making it.
So, got it.
I probably have seen it made, you know. Yeah. I'm going to expose myself here in a minute to say that I'm not doing my kitchen duties very well. I'm very good with mm-hmm. cleaning dishes. If you ever need someone.
Oh, that's good. That's a duty. Yeah. That's definitely a duty.
But whatever you described sounds delicious equally to me. So that's number one. And I'm assuming these are the same authentic recipes, because I know you have a big project in the making related to food and related to hosting and related to doing something in New York, right?
Yeah, my husband and I have been in a very long uphill battle type of process of opening a karaoke bar. And we decided that that kitchen will serve Libyan food and will serve my family's recipes. And I'm really, really excited about that. I'm really excited to introduce my community here that are less familiar with those kind of foods to, especially to bouik. Oh my God, I love making bouik so much. And I love eating it. And I love seeing people eat it. So yeah, I'm really, really, really excited.
It is my wife's favorite, especially in Ramadan. This is what she fantasizes about making every day.
It's so satisfying to make.
Is it a particular recipe? Is it your own recipe?
No, the recipe, it's really funny because the way I was given the recipe is not the way that I make it. So I was given the recipe with do all of it by hand. So spread the batter by hand, peel it off by hand. I do peel it off by hand, but I definitely use a brush to put it on the skillet. And I've burned so many in the process of trying to get it right that now what I do is I have the pot with the potatoes boiling. And on top of that pot, I put the flat skillet and then kind of do like use the steam from the potatoes to cook the leaves, to cook the warka. I think I want to make some now. I'm so excited to make it.
I mean, we can do a part two where we're, you know, we can hear the soundscape of your fully engaged kitchen. You know, it sounds amazing.
I can send you a video of me making it. You can add it to the edit.
No, definitely. It's a definitely nice, satisfying. What are those YouTube videos? ASMR experience.
Oh yeah.
Let's not tease them too much. I don't know. There's no promises being made here. You jumped on a bit of a political angle, which is really interesting for me because I'm not fully updated on what's happening, but yet my wife, Ilham, who's much more engaged and interested in what's happening around the world, pushed me to mail my absentee ballot so I'm able to register and vote.
You're voting in America? Oh my God, that makes me so happy. I could cry right now.
The process is so like, there's too many steps, irrelevant steps. Like, so you have to fill out an application, print it, and print a sticker envelope on the outside to be mailed just to say, I'm interested in voting.
You have to do it standing on one foot with a bird on your
exactly.
head. Yeah, it's like a whole thing.
And there's no guarantee that that will reach, you know, whatever centers. And if it does reach, they'll send me my ballot and then I'll send that again. So it was like, to me, I'm like, it's just no efficiency here, right? Like, you must be screaming inside right now.
It's by design. Though it's the lack of efficiency is definitely by design of like voter suppression. And it is just disgusting to see how unsubtle and how obvious it is to spot voter suppression. And yet it almost seems like there's very little to do against it.
This is just so bureaucratically backward to be that way. But like, how come your husband and you reach the conclusion of, you know, if there's another term for this dude, then there might be no point sticking around. What are the reasons for that? I mean, other than the obvious.
I think being immigrant kind of puts us in a vulnerable spot when there's very much like the immigrant discussion, I guess. Seeing what has been happening this week, for example, with the mass hysterectomies happening in detention centers in Georgia, unconsensual hysterectomies. It's just you know, you walk outside and it's like a beautiful day and there's wind in the trees and the air feels clean and you see people and their dogs and everything feels so normal. And then you hear about these things and you're like, wow, we're sharing a government with this. Like we're sharing, like my taxes are paying, you know, for women to have unconsensual hysterectomies. And that blows my mind. That blows my mind that people are not like enraged by that. And, you know, like there's so many pieces of like insane news stories that the news cycle is saturated by madness. That it's like, oh, mass hysterectomies. It's a Wednesday, you know, and it's like, what have become of us as people that we like normalize this horror and genocidal behavior, you know, and then your head takes a trip outside the US and there's just atrocities everywhere. So, God, I dream of a better world. I started my citizenship application hoping that A, that I could vote at some point, and B, that I could possibly run for office, because this is, it really like feels like a responsibility. It really feels like more people should be involved. So yeah, it's been madness.
It's been difficult, but I mean, I've noticed throughout following you, you're super active, very well organized, very well reaching Black Lives Matter protests.
Yeah.
Oh wow, that's a proper sized dog. Mango would never sound like one. Sorry, what's her name?
She's a nice old German Shepherd. Oh, she's so good.
Reminds me of my first dog, actually. Very similar in size. Thinking of the effect of that, like, have you seen anything materialize? Have you seen anything potentially changing when it comes to all the issues that Black Lives Matter pushed for, focused on, highlighted?
I mean, there's daily results, I feel. There's, like, laws being written into place to protect Black lives, and there's like people are going through their own personal journeys and changing, like, and admitting their own racism. And I'm doing the same, to admit my own racism and to admit that I was brought up to think a certain way, and that's not factual and that's not safe. And it's definitely not kind. So seeing the effort people take, I think is beautiful. It's definitely not enough. And I constantly don't feel like I'm doing enough. And I think that's an important way to feel. I think it's really, I don't think we'll ever do enough until there's actual like liberation. I think there are changes, and I'm so proud of the organizers of this uprising. And this has been like, this has been around. This is not new. It's just, I think, more powerful now because people are not afraid to lose their jobs. People are like, it's a pandemic. We're all unemployed. We all have time to really show up. And it really does feel, there's like a sense of end of days, like vibe in the US, like the sky's red and on fire. And if we're going to die anyway, we might as well die fighting.
Feels like it's
on a lighter note.
Definitely. We're not ending here. Not ending here. I mean, that's what I'm thinking. It as horrible as it feels, and it is quite horrible, as difficult and challenging as it is, it is still a place where you can, as you say, fight back, you know, get your voice louder, group and talk back and try your hardest, and you have a fighting chance.
I pray we do, yeah.
As opposed to, you know, places, you know, everywhere else around the world, that's, you know, racism is not even a highlight of any conversation, even though it's, you know, far and wide. It is so embedded in a lot of cultures. So it, in a way, it feels like we all live in phases, and sometimes like you've had enough and you want to switch off and you want to have a different life, even though like you can reach that impact. So I completely connect with that and I understand it. But the license that you have to travel, like where would that be? Like with your current status, with your current, you know, passport, IDs, what's a realistic option? What's the dream scenario?
The dream scenario would be like probably Morocco, but I don't know if that's a possibility for me right now. So my mom asked that in my journeys to finding out more about my family's history, to see if I can get in touch with somebody who can help us trace her birth certificate in Libya, because she would like to get an Italian citizenship. Her sister has one. few of her siblings managed to get Italian passports, but because her birth certificate is nowhere to be found, we weren't able to start that process for her. So,
and is that a standard process? Like if you born in Libya at a certain year, you get Italian citizenship?
It's basically automatic, from what I understand. Automatic? Automatical? English?
I'll give that to you. So basically, if you're Jewish, born in Libya, and you left that year, these are the elements?
I think so. I believe so, yeah. I know Adam Bencato mentioned that I should probably be in touch with a person named Rafael Luzon, who's kind of like the father of Libyan Jews.
Yeah, he's based in London. I mean, he's quite active on Facebook, and I think he visited, I don't know, 2011, 2012.
He visited Libya?
I think so, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. I think he definitely visited, but sort of this is in the moment of the blurriness of revolution, let's say year one, year two. But he's been essentially pissed off of the aftermath and how difficult it is to go back and how people reacted so negatively. But yeah, I haven't heard about him for a couple of years, but I would say he's your go-to guy. And I think he's also written a book. Have you seen his book?
No. I'm not sure how to get in touch with him. So
Facebook would be a good connect. Also, I have a friend who knows him well. So yeah, I'll see if that's a good connection.
That would help, yeah.
I mean, most definitely. Your mom is just interested in the document. She's not interested in going to Italy and relocate.
No, but I think it would make certain things easier for all of us to... Because my parents adore travel. I think I got the two main things I got from my parents is hospitality and traveling. And I think having an Israeli passport kind of prevents them from going to certain places that they would love to go to. So an Italian passport would be very helpful. But back to your original question, I guess the two places that Ed, my husband and I have been talking about the most were either Mallorca, because his parents have a house there that we can use, or New Zealand, because it just seemed so good. It seemed like such a good place to live.
So far away, lovely nature, different ridiculous time zone that, you know, you're asleep when the world is doing their crazy new cycle and you're up when nobody cares. It's a nice place. I'd love that, actually.
While we're having these conversations, the conversation usually ends with, it's too much to think about in terms of logistics. And I would not, like, my heart is not into the idea of leaving. Because this is home, because we have work to do here. So it's really just like a thing to pass the time, to talk about, to take some of the anxiety away. But to tell you that we're actually considering leaving, I don't know if that's the case.
Sounds like Elham and I's discussion about getting a house in the country and leaving London. It's like an unrealistic project that we spend a lot of time looking at real estate, sharing this house and that place and so on.
I mean, I told you, the apartment next door to ours is... on the market. You guys should be our neighbors. I would love that.
I mean, it's New York is London, really. It's just, I don't know, what a different flavor. It's not, I mean, you guys have a little bit more stable weather, I'd say, a lot more sunnier, more culture, maybe a bit noisier.
Is it noisy?
Yeah, I'd love that for a switch.
I don't think it's noisy.
No. Your place is not noisy at all. No. It's just in my head. I'm conscious that I did not ask you about what it is that you do and work-wise, even though we are in a pandemic and everyone is doing different things differently. But what is it that you do and what do you love about it? And what, you know, introduce us to Corinne and work and creativity. And
so for the past 13 years, I've been a fashion stylist, which is basically like DJ in a way. Like, I don't make the clothes, but I put together the looks and so I don't write the music. I just make the mix. Exactly.
That's a nice way to put it.
So I love my job very, very much, but certain elements of the industry I don't love. And it's been kind of a push and pull of, I really miss being on set. I really miss the teams I've worked with and that I love so much. I really miss the travel and seeing amazing destinations and making beautiful images. I don't miss having to fight over like getting paid. There's an attitude toward the industry of like, if you enjoy what you do, you should be happy to do it for free or for cheap. Or even when you do get the client to agree to your rate, there's like a battle in getting your check eventually. the second to last job that I've had before the pandemic hit. I took the job when Max was 7 weeks old, and it took me so long to get paid. And I think that's absurd that, like, in any industry, you should have to convince people of your worth when they're the one who hired you in the first place. It's just really like, it's a mind because when you're on set, you get praise, you get like, oh my God, these are amazing. I'm so glad you thought about this, blah, blah, blah. And then you're like, where's my money? So it's very exhausting. And and that kind of forces me to consider going to the less creative, like e-commerce part of the industry. But then I don't have the wilderness of putting what I want to put together. So it's been really like, I've been really torn about whether or not I want to stay as a part of the industry. And yeah, I think once the bar opens, I'll probably be more focused on having the bar, being a mom, being a cook, hosting, making events that make people happy. But yeah, I think right now I'm having a really hard time where, like, everything is paused. Yeah, but I think that's for everyone, right?
No, pretty much. And it's kind of it's usually hit and miss in every industry, but there are those clients who are just completely, I don't know what the best description is, but it kind of resonated with me, this not getting paid or paid too late, or like you end up doing so much work to actually get paid after you've done the work. And it makes you wonder, like, how do they think and how do they live and how do they continue working? Because, I mean, just as a random example, I've had to work with an entity that is on the forefront, focuses on freelancers and journalism in general for their rights and so on. And the behind the scenes of getting paid, you have to talk to five different departments and they expect you to send paperwork and original work and during a pandemic and queuing up. And there's no account for the time that you have to put in to do their payment procedures, that it makes you think, well, you actually don't, whatever it is you say that you believe in, you don't really practice, you know, because if you do, you wouldn't be spending so much time and money wasted and having so many conversations about something that is so simple and then takes 5 seconds to do. Yeah, it's kind of hit and miss with those things.
I think freelance, considering that, like, the way I see it, freelance is really not going anywhere. I think freelance jobs are going to be a majority of work in the future, especially with technology becoming more and more active part of the workforce. There really needs to be, like, some kind of protection put in place as a standard of just for employers to kind of be scared of the power of freelancers. The way that, I mean, I just, that's an entirely different conversation, but the whole responsibility of the employers versus the responsibility of the employee, like, an employer doesn't owe you a 2 weeks notice while you as an employee owe your employer a 2 weeks notice. That doesn't make any sense for me. There's just so many things that are for the benefit of the company rather than for the benefit of humanity. And I mean, that was just a slice of what I feel is wrong with the fashion industry. There is much, much, much more that's wrong with it in terms of, again, like, racism.
Representation issues.
Fatphobia, representation. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Where, like, I've had to have arguments to include models of color when the inspiration would be a woman of color. And it would be like, why are we presenting her legacy in a way that's so far from what it should actually represent, you know? So it's been driving me wild. And I really do love my job and I really miss it. But when it brings more anxiety than joy, I don't know if my heart's fully in it.
Is it applicable in a different context? Like, it's surely it is a vision and a mindset that could be used beyond the fashion industry, no?
Probably. I don't know if it's in the same way. But yeah, I think it's just it's really composition. It's really just composing the image you want to present. And I think also with time, the image I want to present is different. The image I want to create is different than, like, white girl going into a taxi. You know, there's like, I don't really see a story there anymore. And you see these, like, tired images in circulation, you know?
It is that one piece of content that, you know, works. You just got to repost it. It's the same thing, right? Like, sometimes it's
like a jazz standard.
Yeah, you got to sell. You got to sell. You got to get those eyeballs. So it's not really easy to escape old things.
And, you know, maybe there's a white girl going into a taxi in my future. but hopefully the story would be deeper than that. Hopefully we'll know where she's going. We'll know what she's about.
Would it be about the Uber driver and she's just the entryway to the scene?
Maybe she's the driver. Maybe this is about workers' rights. Who knows?
You never know. Who knows? Who knows? That sounds very exciting. Opener of the scene.
I feel very silly right now. That's
okay. Tell me a bit more about this bar. So I arrived in New York. I'm going to, what is it? Lower East Side. Is that where it's located?
Uh-huh.
Is it in a corner street? What's the sign saying outside? Is there a map? What are the colors? As soon as I get in, what's the split? What does it smell like? Take me to that place.
All right. So you have a choice to make before you enter the space because it's a split venue. And there's two spaces with two doors.
No. I'm on the street.
You're on the street.
I'm looking at different venues and places. What's going to attract me? What's going to get my attention? What's the sign? What's on the outside before I get in?
Looking at it from the street, you can't see a lot. You see a window, like a circle that you can just see a little bit through. And the window is showing you the stage where the karaoke performer is enjoying their 4 minutes of being a star. As a hobby. And you have a choice whether you want to go into Mini Rex, which is the full bar, full alcohol menu side, or Juicebox Heroes, which is the non-alcoholic nightlife area. And the reason we wanted to do that was because through the years, when I invited my friends to join us for karaoke, there were friends in recovery or pregnant or Muslim. There was always an element of like the staff kind of making them feel uncomfortable with having to order an alcoholic beverage, or if we would go to a bar that's like the bar where my husband and I met, Baby Grand, they've always been super nice and super accommodating to people who don't drink. But people who don't drink also had to face a wall of liquor, which could be quite a temptation if you're in recovery. So we wanted to offer like a nightlife spot that's just feels safe. And we use the term good, clean, fun.
It's one venue. Two different experiences, essentially.
It's kind of like a U-shaped venue. So you have the two entrances and they meet in the back. And in the back is also where the kitchen is that delivers those delicious Libyan dishes. So the two sides are extremely different from one another. One side is very soft and pink and gold and well lit. The stage is these checkerboard with a red curtain, a lot of vegetation. Yeah, it's just super fun. And the other side is more masculine, forest green tones, a lot of brass, leather chairs, beautiful leather sofa. And the entire bar is just really open and welcoming to all, I feel.
When is it opening?
When the pandemic is over.
You can't put a date on that, though. So sometime next year, I'd say, right? You thinking, or sooner?
I mean, I hope so, yeah. So right before the pandemic hit, we were at the really final steps of the final inspections. So just making sure that everything is fireproof, making sure that everything is safe in terms of like emergency exits and everything. Really just final steps from the city to approve the venue. And then the pandemic hit and it's not easy. It has not been easy. But you know, we're, knock on wood, we're just really grateful to be safe.
One way or another is going to end, hopefully. Hopefully soon, hopefully with a lot of people healthy and immune and sane as well. It was a really challenging time for everyone, no matter where they are. And things are also kind of picking up at the moment in Libya in terms of cases. But hopefully they will get better. I mean, considering we're on the topic of food, and for one reason or another, I think it cannot get any more political than when it comes to food battle of ownership and rights and who created this first and all of that. Where are you on that radar of like the hummus war and the, I don't know. Like, cause to me, it feels like you have a fresh perspective of like, okay, you have these recipes that are like, you know, big part of who you are, your family. And yet it'll be confusing to someone who's like, well, that is Libyan food, or like someone, you know, will be fussy about hummus. No, that's Lebanese, Syrian slash. And then someone will say they're Israeli. Like, what do you see that conversation in a particular way? Like, where you part of it? How do you view that? It's our food, it's not your food, it's their food, and all that kind of stuff.
I don't think so. I don't really think about it in those terms, I guess. And it's really funny because where, you know, growing up, for example, a really specific example, the teeny tiny chopped salad growing up was called an Arabic salad.
Yeah, slat arbiya.
And then you go to New York and basically everywhere it's called an Israeli salad, which is not, you know, there's a lot of things that I think with food is really tricky. And my son, for example, has this amazing children's book called Everybody Cooks Rice, which is like, in a way, you know, we cook what we got. I'm not going to start making Thai food in any level and call myself an expert on Thai food, but I think I can. I think I do have the legitimacy to cook and serve expert level Libyan food.
Since we're on a little break, I'd like to share something with you. The production of each episode of the Miri podcast takes about 5 days, and a great effort from a production team consisting of 4 to 8 people. If you love the Miri and would like to be part of the journey and help support it grow, please, please subscribe to Patreon. Your membership fee will take care of important production costs, as well as help the Miri develop and reach bigger audiences. Membership starts from as little as $2. Subscribe via patreon.com/TLMiri. That is patreon.com/TELMERI. You can also click on the link in the description of this episode. Thank you for being part of the team. Since you've been digging and you're still digging, what was your aunt's experience like? I don't know if you got a chance to talk to her directly about being so close to the king, and essentially you mentioned part of the family, and he's the one that managed to plan essentially their last trip out of Libya, and you're including your families as well. What was the relationship like? What are the stories? What pieces of memories are there? Like, how do you imagine that to be, like, according to how you know about it?
The way my mom told me about it is he just adored my family, and we were included in very personal, like, events. My mom and her siblings were always invited to his son's birthdays, for example, and my mom has a very vivid memory of getting a speaking doll that at a time was like the height of technology at one of his son's birthdays. And the boys would get like these really cool trucks. And yeah, there was definitely a very close relationship between King Idris and my family. And when things got dangerous, he's the one that sent the car to kind of take them off the street quickly and hide them where they needed to be hid until he can get them to Italy and from Italy to Palestine. It seemed like there was a very caring relationship there. And, you know, so my son's middle name is Idris after the king. And when you read about King Idris on paper, when you read about him on Wikipedia, there's, you know, you hear stuff like corruption and this and that, but it seems like there was just a theme about him of kindness and a very like caring person. So I think every position of power comes with a certain level of corruption in a way. So I guess I choose to remember him as the man who saved my family.
Generally, I'd say the conversation post-revolution, even during, is this man who loved solitude and almost in a way, politics was not his pie, essentially. It seemed like even the one story that stuck in my head, just to give you a reference of that, is when the coup happened, he wasn't in country. And it seems to kind of really gives you a real indication of his worry and focus is when I think he was in Turkey and he ended up in Egypt.
Egypt, yeah.
Yeah, his only request was, I have my glasses and a very specific shoes, is it possible to just get those transferred? To me, speaks like, you know what, I have everything I need. I need my immediate personal connections. And he never really was into it or like super ambitious. Obviously, when you look at it, different sectors of government and entities that control the country, it's a different story. But when it comes to him, I don't think, he didn't even have a son. I think he had a nephew of sort, and that was sort of second in command.
I think he had sons, but I don't think they made it to adulthood, right?
As far as I know, not, no. But in a way, like he wasn't this like very political, super active figure that was dictator-like or controlling in a way. But obviously, there's always a different story in a different corner of the country that will give you a complete sort of depiction of, oh, that's not true, this is the reality, blah, blah, blah. And so goes the history in a way.
Yeah. I honestly don't even know how he came to be the king, because he was the first and last king of Libya, right?
Put him in the corner here, Karen. You're exposing my limited capacity of history.
I think he was the first and last, and I just don't know how he came to power.
It's something that I need to explore through my Italian phases research. I like this humane, very nice picture of him, that he cared about the people that, you know, cared for him and people that were close to him, and that kind of gave your family this rescue boat, essentially, in this very like troubling, crazy times. Because your mom was 12 years old at the time, right? Like, and she does remember bits and pieces. She wasn't a toddler, but she wasn't like, you know, teenager, you know, at a later stage either. But like, what does she remember? Like, what stuck with you from her memories, from the good times and the bad times, whichever you want to start with?
I honestly, like, she never shared that many stories with me. And it seems like that's almost like an error that she would rather not remember, or maybe she was told to forget. But yeah, that the doll she got was a story I remember. I remember, so apparently my grandfather had an Italian mistress, and he wouldn't listen to anyone. But when she warned him that his store was going to be set on fire, he closed early and he left his store. He would sell like fish, preserved fish and, you know, tunas and anchovies and stuff. And yeah, that same day his store was set on fire, and apparently this Italian mistress saved his life. And same day was when their home was attempted to be set on fire, and my grandmother kind of saved the day and got all the kids out and, you know, turned off all the electric circuits. And like, those are the bits that my mom remembers. My mom remembers the...
This is 67, right?
This is 67, yeah. She remembers that when the car came to pick them up, she remembers how the hangar where they kept them safe, and they had the curtains down to not like, to make sure that they don't know that there's people there. She said, I think it was blue on the outside and the inside had green, dark green curtains. It's those kind of details. It seems like almost like the traumatizing details that she remembers. But yeah, she also remembers the resentment of coming to Israel and being a 12-year-old in a class with 10-year-olds because she didn't speak the language. And my mom is extremely intelligent and she has a very good ear for languages. And I think she's still mad about that, about being an old kid in a younger class.
She didn't speak Hebrew. She spoke Arabic at the time.
Arabic and Italian. Yeah. So she went to an Italian school. She went to a Catholic school in Libya. I think it was called the White Sisters or something. Something Bianchi.
At least I think there's an area called Bianchi as well in Tripoli, somewhere besides the school name. I'm assuming White will be named in every corner. It's probably a trending name to call stuff at the time.
Yeah.
So you have these bits of pieces of a world, and the gist of it is traumatic because of the ending of those chapters, but in a way it's still inviting to you. It's still telling you, this is you, you belong, this is the roots, this is your culture.
The parts that welcome me back in are the people currently. So I guess through Anti-Libyan Club, they posted a post about like, would you welcome Jews back into the country? And the comments were vast and varied, and it was an abundant discussion. So I shared in my stories, and then Anti-Libyans reposted my share, and that kind of brought more Libyans kind of into my DMs, being like, I've never met a Jewish Libyan before. You're absolutely welcome here. A close friend of mine who now we share recipes, she's in our little like Libyan cousins group chat on Instagram that you were a part of before you get overwhelmed by the volume of messages.
I apologize to everyone on the group. It's not a political statement. It's basically my inadequate ability to handle Instagram notifications.
It's all good. I'm sure you understand. Sarah was extremely welcoming, and her first message to me was, my grandmother was orphaned and she was raised by a Jewish family and she remembers nothing but kindness. This is your land as much as it is mine. And it was just like a flow of messages from people who are just so excited to see people who want to be there, be a part of the culture, you know? So that kind of opened up the whole, like, I guess the longing, seeing the kindness coming from people. It's just so beautiful.
I think it's what you just noted is almost like a generational thing. Like, much like in our generation, people that are going through your journey are asking those questions now. It is the same on all the sides, or all the other sides, where people are thinking, well, this country will not be interesting or rich enough if it's just closing its borders to all the different components that make it interesting and, you know, always made it what it is. Very debatable by a lot of people, I'm sure. And you've seen some of that on the comment section from different mindsets on that. But in this exploration phase, did you discover other people on your journey? The people that are trying to find out, trying to connect, have some roots or have bits and pieces of stories, or that's very hard.
Are they Libyan Jews or?
Yeah, yeah.
I remember a few years ago in New York, I was at a picnic in Central Park that a friend organized, and there was another like young man there who's also Israeli. So in Israel, we kind of asked like, what are you in terms of like, what's your ethnicity? Because Israel being so young, everybody's from elsewhere. So he was saying like, oh, I'm Libyan Jew. And I'm like, no freaking way. I've never met another Libyan Jew outside of Israel. And he's like, oh my God, me too. We learned later on that our dads were classmates in high school.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So extremely small world.
Actually, that's something I didn't like. Where are you from? Are you from Tripoli, from Benghazi, from which area was where did your family live?
Both sides' grandparents are from Benghazi. And then later on, my mom, by the time my mom was born, the family moved to Tripoli. So my mom was born in Tripoli. So I think my mom only remembers Tripoli, where her Aunt Norma remembers like Benghazi. And so I don't know if we talked about this, but my upstairs neighbor, also Libyan, who I found out through like the guy at the deli who's Egyptian, long story, his father owned the Wadan Hotel. So Aunt Norma and my grandfather, Nino, used to frequent the casino there like almost every night. And at some point, Jihad, my neighbor, is supposed to bring me a stack of photos that are in his brother's house of his father greeting people coming into the Wadan, hoping that I would find.
He'll probably have a lot more interesting photos, but there is a lot of photos of the Wadan hotel and events and things, either on like a YouTube sort of presentation type thing or like Facebook itself. But I think you mentioned a street name to me before.
The street name where my family was, where my mom was raised?
Mm.
Orba Arsat?
Yeah. Do you know what that means, right?
No. I guess four something?
Yeah, four pillars. Arsa is a pillar. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Huh. Someone could connect it. I don't know. Whoever is listening from a particular generation might say, oh, yeah, that's so-and-so. That's my neighbor, that kind of thing. So your mom and dad did not meet in Libya. So, I mean, she's 12 and she left. So basically, the community stayed together or connected in Israel and in Italy, I'm assuming as well. So they've met in Israel in a different context, right?
Yeah. So my mom was to be matched with her cousin, and she was very much against that. So she refused that arrangement. And then her brother-in-law introduced her to my father that I think was somewhere related to him, either by work or by family. I don't know the full story.
But it's not a rule that the community sticks together, right? Like it's by virtue of...
Yeah, it's not unlikely. It's not unlikely. Yeah.
Okay. So it's someone that, you know, left from Tunis or Morocco or I don't know, even Spain could marry from someone from Libya, right? Or...
Yeah. Yeah.
There isn't that sort of cultural camps of, you know, we got to stick together kind of thing.
No, I don't think so. But I think, you know, being new in a young country, you're more likely to stay with people who speak your language. And I mean, I'm assuming.
No, it makes a lot of sense. It's just sort of, it's always interesting to draw a link and imagine how life takes shape in a new environment. Mm-hmm. And it was a super new environment back then. I'm trying to sort of zoom in much more to your journey itself, because I know you're still constantly digging and trying to find out like who's on your list to ask questions and what are the things to find out and what's on your list for you to be close and satisfied with this journey itself.
I don't know if I'll ever be satisfied with like I don't think there'll ever be like a sensation of like I've arrived, I have all the answers. I think I'm just like a part of me is very bitter that my family would almost let go of that culture, because that's a really like strange conversation that my husband and I had. Because when I told him about the podcast, he said, you're not Libyan. And I said, so generations upon generations of my family that were born in Libya don't count because I was born in Israel. That just cancels the whole culture out. And we got into like a very heated like argument. And again, this is where the imposter syndrome comes of like, am I Libyan? Am I Israeli? What am I? Like, where do I fit in? Where do I belong? Mas'ud was a big help in kind of opening up that journey. Adam Bin Kato and a group of his colleagues released they have a publication called Lama, which I guess translates to gathering, but in Hebrew it translates to why. And I think that's very fitting, about Libya and Libyan history and colonialism and Jewish people in Libya. And it's a fascinating print, and I would highly recommend everybody to get it.
What did you find out from it? Like, what was your discovery reading it?
Well, reading the part about Jews in Libya kind of confirmed a lot of my family's like memories of the time. And it also kind of taught me, you know, about that fuzzy history that we talked about, like who's writing the very recent history. And I guess the reason they put that publication together is because a lot of historical information about Libya was either not written by Libyans or is not available to anybody outside of like a PhD program who would want to learn more about Libya. So they kind of made an accessible publication, kind of putting me on the spot with what I learned from it, because I read it when it arrived a while ago.
No, just the one thing, really. The one thing you're like, oh, this is really interesting or different to what I thought things were. Well, you just mentioned it actually confirmed your findings, and it kind of echoed what your family told you. So that's a major thing to see. So it's whatever other experiences of people's journeys, it's kind of is quite collective, and it gives a bigger picture of that journey.
And I am hoping that that with time I will find other Jewish Libyans trying to find out more and maybe find more connections. But yeah, I'm excited for this curiosity to be there. I guess it's one of those things that I invest my time in. Escapism.
How do you imagine it to be? Picture yourself. I don't want to put you in an airport situation, because that's usually ugly and annoying. I'm not a big fan of airports in general, and you won't have the best experiences in any Libya-related airport. But let's say you are very close to Arba Arsat. You're in the scene and you're exploring around. How would that feel to you? What value would that add to you walking those streets?
There's a sense of comfort. Like I can almost smell the air when I put myself there. And there's just a familiarity of here I am. There was a piece of wrapping paper that Adam sent me from a clothing store that has my family's name on it. So he got it from a person who was a tourist in the 60s in Libya and accumulated a bunch of tchotchkes. And so when he sent me the photo of that, I kind of had an audible gasp of like, oh my God, that's my family's name. I can't believe it. And I found out that it was the father of my mom's classmate, who also shared the same last name, even though they're not related. I, my entire life thought that this woman was related to us, apparently not by blood. But Adam sent it to me. And when I smelled it, it smelled like my grandmother. And it almost was like, you know, like this is it. This like familiarity of like, so this is what Tripoli smells like, but also this is what my family smells like. It's kind of, I don't know, it clicked in a very emotional way. So if I'm putting myself in Arba Arsat, it kind of, that's the smell. That's like the warm smell of heat and like a soft breeze and fresh baked bread.
You almost said burik somehow, but I think it's bread is much more homely, and it takes you to that space for sure. And that's Arba Arsat is in the old city, right? Is that how your parents describe it? Old city of Tripoli, which is a connection that we do have, because my mom was born and raised in the old city herself.
That's funny. One of the people I met through Instagram, through connecting with other Libyans, his mom is my mom's age and they grew up on the same street. And one of the first questions that my mom had for her was, does she remember the midwife who was birthing everybody's children? I think her name was Hamdiye, I think. And she remembered her. And it was just, you know, it's not teaching me much, but it's just like into what my mom remembers. It's pretty interesting.
It's a connection though. Like it's a valid connection, you know.
Absolutely.
I'm sure that's the equivalent of the DJ in town, right? Like the midwife at those times. Like it's as exciting as it gets, but you know, considering your aunt is living a fun, more interesting lifestyle though, in the Wadan Hotel casino nightlife. That's, I mean, I can only imagine it from black and white pictures, and it seems very glamour-like, you know? It's not... It's not the old city life. It's completely different.
I mean, there was something very cosmopolitan, very chic about the photos that I got to see from the Wadan and from that time of, you know, this really like elegant flight staff uniforms and, I don't know, something about that era just seemed so nice.
What are the logistical obstacles for you going there?
You mean aside from like having a dog and a child and stuff? Finding somebody to water my plants? Probably the Israeli passport is a big obstacle. The fact that it's second in the world as most dangerous countries to travel to right now.
Oh, is it number two?
That's, I think so. Bad.
Who's number one?
I think it was Mali.
Those bastards.
I know. They kicked us off.
Could have been number one in something.
Maybe number one.
I'm not going to give you advice on travel to Libya. I should stick to my own, but and I should implement my own advice. in a way, if it's just for the visit and not relocating, it is just getting the right paperwork, I guess, and the right passport, right?
I think so, yeah. When was the last time you visited?
There was a Libya International Airport back then. Now it's no longer there. It's the secondary airport that's being used, which used to be a military airport. So 2015? It's been so long. Okay. It's been so long. 5 years.
When did the airport diminish?
It's that same year.
The same year? Oh, wow.
The airport got demolished in the same year, same month that I left. Oh, yeah. Wow. So it's like literally 2 weeks after I left, it got destroyed.
That's wild.
Yeah. Very exciting times.
That's funny. You know, it's a strange feeling, isn't it?
I think you might have an interesting perspective into what's happening as an observer. Like, I'm sure you listen to the news, you watch bits and pieces of, you know, whatever exciting element of destruction that... people get up to recently and making the situation even more complicated. And you have insights through the cousins page and so on. How do you see it? And how do your parents see it? Like, well, why are you, what's happening is happening, this essential civil war.
You mean in Libya right now?
Yeah, yeah. Sort of this, you know, turbulent situation. Do you have a view on it? Do you have an insight into it? Like as an observer, and you probably like watch it a lot more than I do. I don't know the latest.
Not really. I'm not really involved in it. I think my head is so buried in the past of Libya that whenever I try to understand what's going on there now, I kind of get lost because there's so many agencies at play. And I don't think my parents are engaged in it at all, I'll be honest with you. It almost seems, I mean, it's sad to say, but I guess to the culture in Israel, it's almost like a forgotten land where I guess from their point of view, they're not welcome there anymore. So they don't invest care in it. Yeah. I hope I'm wrong. I'm not here to speak on behalf of like Libyan Jews. And I really hope that I am wrong, but I don't think my parents are engaged.
Well, it is challenging because it's even if someone who's has insights or just left it a year ago and they've stopped following a year ago, it's very complicated to get a grasp on it. Like I find it really challenging because it's too many players and too much interest from a lot of sides to make it easy to understand.
It just sounds like there's a lot of leadership obstacles. There's a lot of misguided leadership and a lot of foreign involvement. So in a way, I don't know if my opinion is even welcome here. I'm not a part of it currently.
Just to be safe, no one's opinion is welcome. Everyone
welcome to Libya, where nobody's opinion is welcome.
Yeah, yeah.
And everybody has one.
Everybody has one, and it's their opinion that matters, and everyone else sucks. That's why we are where we are. So no one gives a shit about your opinion, Karen, then neither my opinion either.
That's the title of the episode, basically.
No, I do. I have to register that. I do care about your opinion.
It's a lonely club.
It's an active minority, right? Or is it, what is that term? The loud minority?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. You know, we just need to get louder. A question related to the podcast. What caught your interest? What is still catching your interest a bit? Even though I feel horribly bad because a lot of the episodes are not in English. Something that needs to be fixed. There needs to be a nice balance. But just as someone who consumed bits and pieces, like what makes it interesting or not to you?
I think it's really funny. I think at first I was just so excited to hear the dialect again. My mother would usually speak Arabic with her mother, and she passed this past March. But yeah, I feel like I haven't heard that sound in so long that was like the initial welcome to get me like through the door. And then the episodes that were in English and just learning like, you know, what ingredients make a Libyan and how extraordinary. Gosh, I can't remember her name.
It's Nada Alfitouri.
Look at you.
Hey, look at that memory. It's usually horrible. So yeah, Nada, that stuck with you for a bit, you said.
I really, really enjoyed that episode so much. And I just enjoyed the thoughtfulness in how she uses her language. Gosh, I found that so beautiful. And just, you know, you're a good interviewer. So the journey was fascinating. And I could probably like, you know, listen to that episode and kind of be regrounded into where I am. Just really enjoyed that episode. And I also noticed a weird time. Basically, every Libyan I come across has a certain fascination with architecture.
Not as exceptional with that because she's in the field and you can tell, like, it's so contagious the way she talks about it. But you're right. I probably, like, even in my little short journey, I interviewed a lot of people who are like in and out of it. I don't know. Do you have a theory? Like, why do we care about buildings and design and architecture?
I don't know. But like so many of the Libyans I come across are either working in architecture or working in interior design, or like Wissal and I would send each other beautiful like apartment listings or beautiful space design images. And I don't know. There's something very, like, it's almost a part of the language. Architecture is like its own dialect for Libyans, it seems. I love that. I love it so much. I don't know what's my theory about what's the attraction, but it's definitely there.
There's two things that we can conclude with, whichever you feel that is exciting to share. Something about how you start your day in order to have something productive. Like, there's a lot of people who listen to this who are like obsessed with hacking and tips and things to make their day better, and you're into efficiency, which is quite cool. I don't know, something you look forward that is future related. It could be work, it could be life, family, it could be traveling to a place. Because I know it's quite blurry and it's a very difficult question to ask us.
It's so blurry, yeah.
It's an election year and it's Corona and it's probably the last thing, you know, to dwell on. But yeah, whichever of these two you find interesting. I don't know, I'm actually interested in knowing what your breakfast is like, considering you care and love so much about food.
Well, my breakfast today was a cheese burekas with some hard-boiled eggs, because that was available and quick. Once we dropped off Max at daycare, we both came back home very hungry. And it was kind of the situation where I need to eat now, and I wanted to make sure that I'm not, like, at the podcast with crumbs in my face. So yeah, that was breakfast today. It was burekas with the hard-boiled eggs. My breakfast usually is, like, eccentric. And yeah, I don't. Like, breakfast is not something that I would forget to eat. I'm not one of those people that forget to eat. I definitely make a priority to eat. So wait, which question is it? What am I looking forward to, or what do I focus my day on? Or?
Yeah, it's morning routines in order for you to have a good day, a good sort of balanced day a la Karen, in order for you to feel happy with the day. First hour, first half. Obviously, you're not in charge of that anymore.
I have a baby.
Time is no longer
mine. But you know what? Even with Max, we put together a schedule that I think I shared it in one of our previous conversations. But basically, we have a...
I'm very impressed by that sheet. Very impressed.
It's making our marriage so much better to not have the both of us be so exhausted and resentful all the time. But just like, this is my part of the day to take care of, and then I get to rest and do what I want, and this is your part of the day to take care of. And, you know, there's some, like, the element of structure. I think it was the director, Sidney Lumet, who said, like, planning ahead gives more room to spontaneity. It doesn't take away spontaneity. It's allowing you to have the safety to go out of it because you know that the structure will be there when you return. So I think that's definitely, like, kind of a life... like a life philosophy of, like, plan ahead.
It's almost like my messy notes. I write them down that I won't be able to read them again because it really sucks. But mentally, it feels like I've planned this. But I half the time I don't know what I'm doing and I don't know what I'm talking about. But it just feels good because it's not a blank page. It's not scary. But yeah, it's useless.
A blank page is really scary. It's really scary. I totally get that.
So in terms of practicality, is it 50-50? Is it half day for him, half a day for you? You get a day of the weekend. Like what's the real tip here for a fair and functional split between you?
Basically, I always take care of breakfast and my husband always takes care of dinner. And another new law that we've implemented is whoever is cooking is also responsible to cleaning the kitchen to be spotless after the meal.
Oh, wow. That's tough. That's hardcore.
Yeah.
That's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. And then the lunches alternate. And then, for example, if my husband is supposed to make dinner, but he doesn't want to, he can pay me with these colorful cards that we've made. And you write the dates on the back. But yeah, a pink card is a baby shift. And a yellow card is either an off-shift diaper, which I hate changing diapers. So I would pay my husband all the time to change diapers, or making a baby meal.
What do you exchange for the card? Do you exchange turns then? Or
so yeah, we would exchange turns, or like, let's say one of us didn't have a good night's sleep and we don't want to do the morning shift. We would pay the other one to do the baby shift in the morning. And it kind of makes sure that whoever is with the baby is kind of giving undivided attention and just being present. So the baby doesn't get a cranky parent.
I think for that phase, like 1 to 2, 1 to 3, it is sort of a secret to know that the right split, which is what you're doing, is the only way to maintain your sanity throughout. Otherwise, you're both going to be exhausted because you're both involved all the time, or like one will be destroyed because the other person is not doing much. I hope Ilham does not verify this and listen to it. She's like, oh, he's complete bullshit. He didn't do anything. He didn't even change. But no, I do value, because I remember Saturday, a big chunk of it was completely untouchable for her. And I've noticed how much difference that made, even though she felt guilty. She's like, oh, I want to be involved. I want to do this. I'm like, no, don't even call. I'm not even going to send updates. You just switch off.
It's so important.
Otherwise, it does not stop, because, you know, the amount of energy and attention a baby needs is just, you know, endless.
You're also kind of teaching the baby how to be, and teaching yourself. You're learning at the same time how to be a parent. It's kind of like very parallel. So when the baby was just like a few days old, I still have not gotten any sleep, and the baby was sleeping, and I, you know, my husband was sitting at the desk, and I came and I started like crying, and he's like, what's going on? And I told him, I'm so tired. And he said, okay, you go in that room and close the door. I will be with the baby in this room and close the door. And if he needs you, I'll bring him, but like, go sleep. And those 2 hours of sleep that I got were like phenomenal. And yeah, like I still can't sleep in the same room with the baby, because I would be so hypervigilant and I wouldn't be able to get any rest. So my husband was the one sleeping with him at night, and I get blissful sleep before my son was a year old, which is something that you don't really hear young mothers like experience. So yeah.
And it's a tough decision to take, obviously, but obviously result of that is much more valuable to you and to him and to your husband as well. Is there anything you want to share? Anything that I did not remember or did not ask?
It's really funny, because like yesterday I was asking people on my stories for advice on how to stay emotionally and physically energized, because I've been extremely tired this past week. Just very, very, very drained. And I'm really grateful for this conversation and the timing of this conversation, because I feel like after we finish our chat, I'm going to put a new chart in place for the days to come. And hopefully kind of get like a nice groove, like getting into a nice rhythm of things again. But yeah, this was so fun. And I'm going to take my own advice on how to be efficient.
Thank you so much, Corinne. I really, really, really enjoyed it. And I hope, you know, you did too. And I hope anyone listening who learned something and excited to find out a bit more about you, or even has something to share and help you through your journey of discovering your story and roots.
Yes, hit me up.
I'm excited to find out more.
Me too. Thank you so much for having me. I'm like honored that at your interest at all. And this was beautiful. Feeling very lucky.
This is it for this week. I've been your host, Tariq Almiri. Graphic design by Nanka Designs. Motion graphics by Mustafa Bin Umran. Stay tuned for next week. You'll be listening to...
أنا مثلاً التغيير جداً إيجابي. أنا شايفة نفسي أنا شخص جديد. أنا انولدت من جديد. أنا شايفة نفسي أنا شخص قادر إن هو يواكب الجيل متاعه.
This is it. See you next week.